For a long time, I had this kind of personal unwritten rule. I could either have a watch or sunglasses. And whenever I would get a new watch, I would promptly lose the pair of sunglasses that I had. And if I replaced the sunglasses, then I would lose my watch. And I'm kind of a professional loser of sunglasses, hats, and fleeces. Arwen Nix, what are some things that you lost?
It's one thing. One thing that makes me feel like a total loser and a total finder. And it's my little leather wallet.
So I'm Gabriel Spitzer here with senior producer Arwen Nix on Sound Effect here on KPLU. And this week we're talking about lost and found. And so this wallet, Arwen, how many times would you say you've lost it?
Honestly, Gabriel, without any hyperbole, over 25 times.
That is absurd.
I know.
I mean, is it on a string? How does it keep coming back to you?
No, I mean, I've had friends suggest that I get like one of those wallet chains that perhaps would match my love for grunge music, but I just have never done it. And the reason I don't do it is because the wallet does always come back. The wallet has fallen out of my pocket. It's fallen out in cabs. I lost it on the beach once. But it finds me in the most novel ways. I had a police officer return it two different times. Two different cops have brought it back to me, finding my business card in there and bringing it to my work. I had someone, a little kid, find it and turn it into an ice cream shop, which was adorable. And another time I had this lady tell me that she found it on the street. She invited me into her home and she wouldn't let me leave, like wouldn't give me my wallet back until I agreed to stay for a seance and come back for the moon ceremony because we were obviously fated to be in each other's lives. And I lied and said that I would come back, but I just took my wallet and left.
You missed the moon ceremony?
I did.
Maybe that's why you keep losing it. Do you think that the universe is trying to tell you something, Arwen?
That's what I can't figure out. I can't figure out if it's the luckiest wallet in the world or the most unlucky wallet, but it's changed the way that I interact with lost objects.
So when you find something that somebody has lost, you think of it differently now.
I found someone's wedding planning book that had like no way of knowing who this person was. They had all these scrap pieces of paper, and I finally was able to montage together the scrap pieces of paper until I found the phone number of a temp service, called the temp service, and found out where the woman had been placed and returned her wedding planning book to her.
Whoa.
And I get so excited when someone brings it to me that like the idea that I could give someone that same level of joy is really exciting.
Yeah, because when someone returns something that you lost, especially if it's like a wallet and it's still got the money in it, it's more than just getting back your stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, losing that wallet during Gay Pride one year at the Cuff, I never thought I was going to get it back. And not only did I get it back from a really nice leather daddy, but it had all the money in it.
And that kind of restores your faith in humanity a little bit.
Every single time it does.
Well, today on Sound Effect, stories of lost and found. That's coming up right after we invite some friends over to help us break down the week's news. So stick around. Well, the news panel is a little bit unusual this week. For our Lost and Found show, we are going to be thinking back to a loss of 6 years ago this month. It was when the Seattle Post-Intelligencer ran its last print edition off the presses. And of course, the PI still exists online, and we're going to be hearing from reporters who work there in future panels. But for today, we've asked three alumni of the Seattle PI to come help us break down the week's top story and the underreported stories of the week. So welcome to Art Thiel, who's co-founder of Sports Press Northwest, and he's a contributor to Crosscut and to KPLU. Mike Lewis is a freelance journalist and the owner of Streamline Tavern, and Tom Paulson's founder and editor of Humanosphere. Hey guys, welcome to Sound Effect.
Hey. Greetings. Hey. Good to be here.
So for our top story this week, of course, we have the ongoing and curious case of the state auditor, Troy Kelly, subject of a federal investigation, and details have been kind of emerging, trickling out this week, and then we've had some good kind of deep dives in various media outlets, and I just wonder what you guys have learned that may have come as a surprise to you about Troy Kelly, about his office, or about this investigation.
For me personally, remembering the name of the state auditor has been the first development, because I just didn't when the news stories first broke, I had to remind myself who he was, and it turns out that his staff may had to have been reminded who he was as well, given his office attendance. But I think it's been an interesting story, but it's been detail short at this point.
Tom, is this how familiar were you with the position of state auditor before this, and how much did you know about Troy Kelly's resume?
Well, I was fairly familiar with the auditor's office. Brian Sontag, the previous auditor, he was pretty high profile, and it's sort of odd that it's become such a big story since we don't really know the gist of the investigation. And like Mike says, I think it's, I suppose because he's a public official, it's newsworthy that this is being investigated, but it's sort of like being found guilty before all the evidence is in. We don't really know. I mean, what happens if they find nothing?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, like, what are there shoes to drop, I wonder? And what are, like, the big sort of unanswered questions at this point that you will be watching
for? Well, the thing that struck me was, I mean, the auditor's office, even though it's fairly obscure to the average voter, citizen, it's in charge of keeping tabs on the government. And the thing that struck me about this is that if you don't have a high-functioning person in there or doing things in an honest, transparent way, state government's in trouble. Because as it relates to the news business, the reporting of government has faded in the last 10, 15 years. And that's kind of a scary proposition. I remember a story, I think it came out in about 2009, where somebody surveyed the number of credentialed media. In the mid-90s, there were 37 credentialed reporters for radio, television, and newspapers covering the state legislature on a full-time basis. And as of the date of that story, which I guess is 2009, there were nine. One legislator was quoted as saying, "The mice will play." Because there are no longer people like Shelby Skates or Dick Larson, you know, guys who walked the halls of the legislature and the legislators scurried into corners. That just doesn't exist anymore.
This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm talking with three Seattle PI alumni this week. It's Tom Paulson, Art Teal, and Mike Lewis. And we've just been talking over our top story, the investigation into state auditor Troy Kelly. So now we're going to move on to our underreported stories of the week. Mike Lewis, what have you got in mind for something you'd like to see a little bit more coverage of?
It's funny. The underreported, I was thinking about this earlier in the week, and the underreported story actually ended up being a story in today's paper regarding the people moving out of King County. We have census data, which indicates that it's happening. We don't have the underpinning as to why it's happening, but I think we all probably know at least part of it. I know that in our business, in the bar business, we're having staff move south who can't afford to stay in Queen Anne, who would rather be in the neighborhood, and we're losing customers because some of our regulars who have spent a lot, we're a neighborhood bar, so a lot of our regulars are people who've been in Queen Anne for a long time, and they're finding themselves priced out, and none of this is necessarily intrinsically bad, but it's definitely changing, and it really hasn't been well reported, I think, to date.
All right. Tom Paulson, underreported story?
It's the world's largest trade deal being negotiated. It has local impact, so it's not a local story, but it's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. It's not getting covered, and it's sort of interesting to me that, you know, with all of the coverage, talking about Troy Kelly and how we need to make government transparent and make the world safe for democracy. It's being negotiated by the Obama administration in secret. WikiLeaks is the only reason we know anything about it. And it has huge implications for us in terms of costs of drugs. It's all about intellectual property. It sets up an independent legal system that actually goes around national legal systems. And so corporations can actually sue countries for their environmental or labor laws. And a lot of people think it's a great thing. It'll improve trade. I mean, so it goes back and forth. But I don't understand why it's gotten so little coverage, not just here in Seattle, but everywhere. But it'll really affect us because of our export-import. So this deal is going to have a huge impact on what we pay for things and even how we try to regulate corporations. And it's not getting much coverage at all.
All right, one more underreported story. Art Teal, what's your nominee?
Bertha, even though there's been a lot of coverage, I drive by there every day, and I look at that.
Slowly.
I get a chance to look.
You get a chance to linger.
Yeah,
I'm right past there.
And to me, it's like this sort of surreal semi-Mad Max thing going on there with all this gear and construction and, you know, desperate-looking people. And so I really want to know more. And I you know, I realize the Seattle Times is incrementally covering the daily, you know, inchward that Bertha is making. And that's fine. But how does this giant thing in the very living room of Seattle function with so many moving parts, so many layers, and so many so much finger pointing going on quietly about who's responsible for what, and everybody's saying, "Well, we'll work that out later."
Yeah, exactly. Hard to tell who's in charge.
Right, and I would like to read an interview for the guy who knows everything about what's going on in that space.
When you think of underreported stories, it's tempting, again, to think of what it means for the city to have lost the second print newspaper. And, of course, as we mentioned, the Seattle PI exists online today as ever, but it does not exist in print anymore. And I just wondered, as we move into our Lost and Found show, where you guys are with kind of processing the loss of the print PI. You know, how are you feeling about it these days, and how has that evolved since it actually happened? And Tom Paulson, maybe we could start with you.
I'm personally affected by it, of course. I mean, I complained the entire time I worked there, and then
yeah.
And now that it's gone, I realized how lucky we were. What a great place it was. I mean, we did some really good journalism there, and it's just to me, it's a huge loss for the community. It's not unique to Seattle, but I don't think people understand what it means when you remove 100 journalists from a city.
Artiel, your thoughts?
Well, not only did we lose the jobs of 100 journalists, the Times is half of what it was. Mm-hmm. And the television stations aren't in any position to do much about that. There's more television news on, but it's not there's not new stories in there because they're not adding to their newsrooms either. In fact, they're shrinking. The television ratings for news programs, and I've had a chance to look at this, used to be in 10, 11, 12, 13, 15 rating points. Now they're down to 2, 1, and 0. Nobody's watching television news. So in order for a city to be well-informed about itself, it needs big newsrooms full of people who are experienced. I'm not saying that an individual blogger or an individual reporter can't make a contribution, but to do something exhaustive takes a big newsroom. And we are much diminished, not only in this market, but every market.
How about you, Mike Lewis?
I spent some time working as the regional editor for Patch.com. And what occurred to me is I hired some experienced journalists and some fairly inexperienced journalists. And we worked remotely, and we worked hard, and we did a lot of posts every day. But the one thing that I always felt a little bad about was some of the folks there never got the chance to sit in a newsroom and learn from the ambient reportage going on around you. I mean, I don't know how many times in the PI newsroom I got a chance to get better as a reporter, one, being competitive maybe with other people on staff and maybe being competitive with the other newspaper, the other media operations in town, but just sitting and listening to, you know, not to name drop, but a Jane Hadley interview, you know, which was always a delight for everyone in the PI newsroom because she would really walk someone right back to the wall and make them have to answer. And typically it was involving local government. And so I think the PI was a great birthing place of very good journalists who went on to bigger things. And I think that the loss of that, everyone suffers as a result.
Well, it is a loss for many of us. I'm glad to say that our three distinguished Seattle PI alumni here at this table have all found really interesting projects, entrepreneurial projects, and I would definitely encourage everybody to check them out. So thank you so much to Art Teal, who's co-founder of Sports Press Northwest and a contributor to Crosscut and KPLU. Mike Lewis is a freelance journalist and the proprietor of the Streamline Tavern. And Tom Paulson, who is founder and editor of Humanosphere at humanosphere.org. Thanks, guys, for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU, and this week we're talking about Lost and Found. And if you've ever lost a pet and been lucky enough to find it again, then you know what a little melodrama it is. There's this sense of doom, and you're expecting the worst, and then this wave of relief when you get reunited with the dog or the cat or chinchilla or whatever. Well, KPLU's Jennifer Wing experienced this roller coaster so many times that she has lost count, and it has all revolved around the same animal, this cat named Snowdrift. Jennifer says, yeah, Snowdrift was technically lost a lot, but she's not sure whether Snowdrift ever really wanted to be found.
As soon as we brought Snowdrift home, he had to be out exploring, whether it was terrorizing small children next door.
Snowdrift has been in the house, and Maya and her playdate are terrified.
Or hopping into cars and going home with strangers who lived miles away.
Hey, George and Jennifer, we have never met, but we've met your cat, Snowdrift.
The phone rang because of him more than anyone else in her house. But before we get into all of his adventures, the frustration and anguish he caused, and his secret life, Snowdrift started out as a six-week-old kitten from the hilltop neighborhood of Tacoma. Our old cat died. Our daughter, Lucy, started looking at ads for kittens on Craigslist. She instantly fell in love. We let her give this gray, striped tabby with a pink nose a name, and she chose Snowdrift.
We didn't know he was a boy, so we got him, like, pink everything. The pink bed, little pom-poms, and pink toys.
George, my husband, made sure we were extra careful walking around the house.
He was this tiny little cotton ball. My main concern was that one of us would step on him and kill him with a single step because he was the size of a small plum.
One of the first things we did when we brought him home was give him a bath and pick dozens of fleas off his little body. He was absolutely adorable. At night, we would put him in bed with Lucy.
All of a sudden, I could see his tail twitching, and then he would start scratching and biting. He would just go bonkers.
Like clockwork, Lucy would call out,
"Mommy, can you take Snowdrift out of my room?"
Night after night after night.
"Mommy, can you take Snowdrift out of my room?"
"Mommy, can you take Snowdrift out of my room?"
"Mommy, can you take Snowdrift out of my room?"
"Can you take Snowdrift out of my room?"
By about 3 months old, he would slip past our legs and go out the front door or hop out of windows two stories up. After Snowy got his first taste of hunting, he could not be contained.
I remember when he got his first mouse and I tried to take it away from him, and this deep guttural growl came from deep within, like, and he would not let me have his mouse, ran off and ate it. It was his first kill. I think he was only a few months old. He loved it.
He'd bring small birds into our bathroom, leaving a mess of feathers, two little toothpick legs and a head. Then he moved up a size and started attacking our neighbor's chickens.
"Hello, it's the people down the street that have had a problem with your cat for about 4 months.
Next message.
Your cat got into the yard again, and I have called several times about this, and this is my final call. If we can figure out some way to not have your cat eat my chickens. I've been here for 13 years, and my chickens are 6 years old."
Things got really bad the day Snowdrift ate a toe off of one of the beloved chickens.
"Yep, we paid the vet bill, and the chicken did appear to be missing a toe."
He chased one chicken down 45th Street to Dick's Burgers. Another time, he scared one into the Guild 45th movie theater. One of the hens was so frightened, it crossed a busy road and ended up at a taco shop. Some customers there took her home to their place in SeaTac, and her neighbor eventually got her back after posting a $100 reward on Craigslist. Snowdrift was becoming a menace. It was around this time he would disappear for hours and hours. He'd always come back, but often the day stretched into the evening, the evenings would blur into the early morning hours, and then the phone would ring.
"Next message sent on Tuesday, July 23rd at 3:23 a.m.
"Hi there, my name's Pat, and I found your cat. Yeah, I work at the Iron Bowl up on 45th and Bagley, so, yeah, I'm not really sure what to do. And I believe that I've seen this cat here before. You like to come over to our bar."
The Iron Bowl Sports Bar, Al's, a pub around the corner, and Changes on 45th. That was Snowdrift's favorite bar. There are 3 50-gallon fish tanks in Changes. It's like premium cable TV for cats.
"Hey, George, Jennifer. Hey, Snowball's at Changes again. He's just chilling here looking at the fish, so you're wondering where he is. He doesn't want to seem to leave today, though. He just wants to hunt fish."
For a couple of years, our phone would ring quite often at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and it would be somebody in some bar who got our cat. And I remember one of those trips, I went to the bar called Changes. And they have kind of a back patio. And I made my way back there, and I found Snowdrift in the arms of two very large women who were cuddling him and blowing pot smoke into his face. And he was purring and seemed incredibly content. And I thought, maybe there's not a problem here. Maybe I don't need to take this cat home. So I think I just left.
At Changes, Snowdrift found his people. At Changes, he was Snowball.
The Wallingford bar cat.
He'd lounge around on the pool tables. He'd look at the fish. He even got along with the dogs that the regulars brought in on leashes. The cat that drew blood from us at home was a different animal here.
Pretty sweet. Like, if you could capture him, you could pet him.
He really wanted to
cuddle a lot. Was like, please pet me. Yeah. I'm going to lay in your lap.
He would climb. If you didn't have your jacket unzipped, he'd climb in and just, like, cuddle under your jacket and stuff. He's so sweet.
It was definitely persistent, because I was walking up this way, and I'm allergic to cats, and he's just all over me. I'm like, I don't like you. Go away. Go away, you know. But it just so followed me all the way up here. I'm like, it was just like right in front of my feet. I'm like, fine, I'll pet you.
That's Allison, Deborah, Kelly, and James, some of the regulars at Changes, and Snowdrift's adopted family. Sorry, I mean Snowball. Allison remembers one day when everyone feared for Snowball. He crossed 45th and made it through the double doors at Murphy's, the Irish bar across the street from Changes.
The fact that he'd made it over to cross 45th was like a big deal in the neighborhood. My God.
It was a scandal.
The bar cat made it across 45th? Is it okay? And so everybody started talking like, is Snowball okay?
What is it with these people? Why them and not us? One person who might have an answer is Kat Albrecht.
I'm the founder of Missing Pet Partnership, and I also am a Pet Detective Academy instructor where I teach other people to be pet detectives and to help families find their lost pets.
She knows why pets run away and the tricks to get them back. Pheromone sprays that smell like a mother cat can lure a lost cat into a box. Dogs are trained to sniff out cats hiding in roofs and tucked under porches.
I'm suspecting that the behavior that you saw with Snowdrift was not that he didn't love your family, not that he didn't want to live in your house, but that he was too afraid because something traumatic had happened, and that he associated you and your family and coming into your house with that experience to the point that he wanted to get away each time.
We did not abuse this cat. We treated him well. George suspects it was the other beast in her house that drove Snowdrift away.
Well, we got a dog.
But that doesn't really make sense, because Snowy got along with the dogs people brought into Changes. Maybe it was our young children who were sweet with him, but...
Maybe he was more jealous than he ever appeared to be.
Or perhaps we just weren't enough.
I just think that for him, the world was this beautiful adventure, and we were the most boring part of it. I think that bar Changes was more exciting than staying at home and eating kibble. So, good for him. He saw the world on his own terms.
Kat Albrecht, the pet detective, says all it takes for some cats to run away is one bad fight.
And when they are pushed from their territory, they're oftentimes going to be too afraid to come back to that territory.
If this is what happened to Snowdrift, that he got turfed out by a bigger, meaner cat, then 45th Street, where Changes is, was clearly his new territory. He owned that strip. If you go there today, you won't find him. The very last call we got about Snowdrift came from a young couple who live about 6 blocks away from us. He was hanging out in their yard. He ate a nest of baby hummingbirds in their tree. They overlooked this and saw him for the beautiful, small, gray-striped tabby he is and asked if they could keep him. It was time for us to let him go. When I went there with the kids to say goodbye, Snowy took one look at us and dived under the sofa. Snowdrift's new life does not include a dog. It does not include any children. Somehow they are keeping him indoors where he gets to look at a fish tank. His new life also includes a new name, Babau. Babau is what the artist Salvador Dali called his cat, a wild ocelot from the jungles of Colombia, a creature who was said to only be happy when he was able to escape his civilized surroundings.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. And if you like seeing cat pictures on the internet, and who doesn't, you could see pictures of Snowdrift at the bar, as well as a map of all the places that he was found at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're talking about Lost and Found. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, actually, so I don't mess up the pronunciation of your name.
My name is Huai Hung Tran.
Huai Tran lives in Seattle, and she lost a chunk of her history and her identity when her family fled Vietnam in the 1970s. But she was just a little kid back then, and she very quickly adapted to life as an American. She finally returned to Vietnam in her late 30s, and by then, the thing that she'd lost was so remote, she wasn't even sure where to start looking.
My father at the time was ill, and he really wanted to find his brother, half-brother.
So you went there armed with the name of a town and limited Vietnamese language
yes.
skills. What did you do first?
Well, I was staying at the Hanoi Hilton. I went to the concierge, and I asked him for a driver. And I told her, the concierge, that I wanted to go to this specific place. I handed her a note with the name of the town. And she looked at it. She was shocked. And she said, well, you know, this is not a town. This is a province. Probably around 900 kilometers or something like that.
900 square kilometers?
I think so.
That's a lot of ground to cover.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
Did you have any other clues about where they might be? Did you know their names?
I actually have a picture of my grandfather. So just to backtrack a little bit, my father was a North Vietnamese man who immigrated to the South in 1954. And my grandfather, who was a landowner at the time, well, he was executed. So he had only a little picture of his father.
And so you were looking for your father's half-brother. You have a picture of their father.
Right.
Who had been dead for 50 years
yes.
or something like that. And so based on that, you were hoping that, I mean, what were you hoping for? How did you see this playing out in your head?
That's a good question. I had hope.
So tell me what happened. Walk me through the search.
Okay. So we got into the cab and we stopped at the first town. He got out and he showed pictures of my grandfather and talked to people. At the next town, he did the same thing, and on we went. 2 hours later, he turned to me. I was in the back of the cab and he said, do you still want to continue? And I said, yes, just continue. And we just, everywhere we went, we got out and ask people and show them the picture of my grandfather.
So what happened next?
Well, what happened was that we drove and drove, and finally the cab stopped. He got out of the car, and he beckoned me to follow him. So I opened the cab, and I walk out, and he said to me, we're at the end of the road. Literally, end of the road.
Like the road doesn't go on anymore?
The road did not go on. I mean, it just stopped. He took out his cigarette, and he smoked, and he said, well, what now? And I looked around, and I was very disappointed. So I said, well, okay, all right, back to Hanoi. As we're getting ready to get back in the car, there's a guy, a little young man with a moped. He said, I heard a Viet Q, that's me, Viet Q, Vietnamese American. She's searching for her grandfather. And the cab driver nodded, and he said, I'm her cousin. And the cab driver showed a picture of my grandfather, and he said, "Yeah, that's my grandfather." And so then
what did you do? Did you hug or nod at each other?
Well,
you never met before.
Exactly. Well, I kind of wave, and then he beckoned me and the cab driver to follow him. And as we're going towards the estate, the big house. I think at the time it was very glorious, but it's been 60, 70 years of war and poverty. It's half burned down. There was a pig, I remember, living in one of the rooms. And I remember all the relatives gather around to talk to me and actually to figure out who I was.
Were they expecting you? Did they know you were coming?
No, they did not.
What a strange thing it must have been for them to have you drop out of the sky.
I think so.
What did it feel like for you to then be reunited with this family that you had not known before? Like, you didn't know the loss of them, but here you are finding them. What was that like?
Well, wow. It was really interesting to know where you came from. I never knew any part of my father's family life, because at the time when I was born, I live in central Vietnam. We didn't have access to North Vietnam. When I left to go back to Hanoi, my half-uncle wanted a picture of his father, because when he was executed, all the pictures were burned. And so he asked me to send him a picture. When I returned to the United States, I did. And when my parents died, my half-uncle asked me for their pictures. And then later on, a couple months later, I saw that he gave my mom a place in the family's altar. So the result of me finding them gave my mom a place in my paternal family.
Do you feel any different as a result of this? Do you feel like you gained something in your picture of yourself?
Definitely. What lesson I learned, especially from this, is that you have to try. I remember as I stood there looking at the dirt road, thinking this is the end of the road, but I try as much as I could.
Wai Tran is a Seattle writer, and her essay about this journey to find her half-uncle in Vietnam appeared originally in the online literary nonfiction magazine Diacritics. Wai, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stick around for more tales of lost and found coming up after the break right here on Sound Effect on KPLU. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories of losing and finding. And you're about to meet a guy named Travis Gleason. In the late 90s, he was a star chef in Seattle, and then in 2001, he was just at the peak of his culinary career, and he got some really devastating news. Gleason had multiple sclerosis. Then Gleason wound up moving to Ireland. It was there, he says, he found some clarity. He tells the story of it in his new book, Chef Interrupted, and he sat down to talk with KPLU's Dick Stein, and they started with a reading from the book.
Living with multiple sclerosis, MS, has made me live my life in fast forward. But first, there was an adjustment period. The events I'm about to recount transpired nearly 5 years after my diagnosis, 5 years during which more adjustment was required than I'd prefer to recall. In that time, the career with which I identified myself was ripped away. A strong marriage crumbled, and subsequent relationships faltered as I stumbled my way through the ruins of my former life. I came to realize that MS is not a death sentence, it's a life sentence. And while anyone could step into the street and be hit by a bus, people living with MS have seen the bus. We've been hit by the bus, and we know that for the rest of our lives, we will walk along the bus route with our backs to traffic.
The theme of this week's program is Lost and Found, and what you lost was a very successful career as a chef. How did MS take that away from you?
When I was 35 years old, that April of 2001, I had symptoms that were stroke-like. I thought I was having a stroke. My left side was going numb and heavy. My face was drooping and all of that. So like a 35-year-old American male, I made an appointment with my massage therapist.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's actually going on with MS. In the book, you kind of describe it as the body eating the insulation off of its own wires.
If you think about it, your brain is a telephone, and every part of your body, organs, muscles, nerves, everything is another telephone. And the cables that we see along the street carrying the signals, they're insulated by a thick rubber coating that insulates the copper, which actually transmits the signal. In my body, in our brains and central nervous system, that insulation is called myelin. in multiple sclerosis, the body's immune system eats away at that myelin, that rubber coating. So those copper wires, if you will, start to corrode. They rust. They scar. Multiple sclerosis means many scars in Greek. So if you think about what a phone conversation would sound like, one phone to another, if it's going through one of these areas of corrosion, it might be staticky, and that might be pins and needles or a sizzling pain that someone feels with MS. Sometimes you would hear every other word, and so that might be a tremor kind of thing that's coming from the body. So the bad part is sometimes the connection is just lost. And if it's lost, numbness occurs, lack of control. When a connection is severed, a lot of times that's permanent.
Well, all of this ended your career as a chef and a consultant, and as you said, ended your marriage. What were the issues that caused your marriage to end?
After years of therapy, I figured out that it had to do with a worthiness kind of thing. I believed that persona of the chef that everyone else had created around me, and I tried to live out to that, you know, that ballooned exterior. And when MS popped a pin in that, the whole thing deflated, and I flailed around, literally and figuratively, to figure out my way out. And a lot of things, a lot of people were damaged in that process. But, you know, once I did make it out, I did have a kernel of who Travis Gleason still was. And that was the time that I could start to rebuild this new life.
Well, what I'm taking from the book is that the beginning of the new life was in Ireland.
I went there to fulfill a very old desire, dream, and started to realize that there was something new out there. It was restorative to me. I guess there, more than anything else, I learned the importance and the value of laughing at my own self. You know, the roads in Ireland ended up being a metaphor for how I was learning to live my life with MS. It has to do with looking far enough ahead that I could meet oncoming traffic at a time and a place of purpose and intent. Because if you're looking just at the next curve, you're not being responsible to everybody that's in the car. You're not seeing what might happen. But if you look too far down the road, then you miss all the beauty that's all around you. So I had to figure out a way to look far enough ahead to answer two or three of those, well, what ifs with, well, then I woulds. And that metaphor really kind of served me through my time in Ireland and then afterwards. It was looking far enough ahead to be responsible, but not looking so far ahead that I miss the joys of life.
Well, we've talked a little bit about what you've lost when all of this came down upon you. What have you found?
Wow, that is a really good question. I think I've found an inner peace, and as I say in the book, I came to the realization that retirement for me was not going to find me 70 years old in a canoe fishing in a pond in Vermont. If I was going to experience any of those things that I hoped to do at some point, then I was going to have to figure out a way to make them happen. No, they haven't happened in the way I thought. They haven't happened in the way I dreamed, but I've made some of them happen. So that's, I think, what I've taken from this. And I say this emphatically to people, and this is my own little bailiwick, is that if anyone lives better or feels more connected with something after a diagnosis and after coming through the dark periods that can cause, it's because the good was already in them. And they reached down into a really dark, nasty, smelly, filthy place of disease. And they found a kernel of goodness that was in them. And they dragged it out and dusted it off and took that and grew with it. It was already there. And I like to say, MS didn't teach me anything, but I've been a good student of what was there to learn.
Former Seattle chef Travis Gleason speaking with KPLU's Dick Stein. His new book is called Chef Interrupted. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about Lost.
Hello, Gabriel.
Hey, Gabe.
Hello, Kevin Kniestad, producer of Sound Effect. Arwen Nix, senior producer of Sound Effect. What are you guys doing here?
Gabriel, I had the perfect story for this Lost and Found show, but Arwen told me that I ruined it.
I told him that because he did ruin it.
I didn't ruin it. It just didn't quite turn out as I imagined.
You ruined it.
Okay, kids, this is public radio. We are not comfortable with people disagreeing. Okay, let's just get along here for a moment. We've got a few minutes. Why don't you just tell us what you had in mind, Kevin? What would it have been like if this had worked out? Would that be okay with you, Arwen?
I guess it's fine.
Thank you, Gabriel. So back in November, I was out with a friend at this bar in Magnolia, and they had karaoke going on that night. And it was pretty much what you might expect on stage for karaoke. Some singers were okay, some singers were maybe less than okay, and then 1:30 in the morning rolls around, and me and my friend had paid our bill and we're getting ready to leave. And then this woman goes on stage, and what you typically expect, or at least what I typically expect at 1:30 in the morning from people doing karaoke, is something like this. But it was nothing like that at all. In fact, she didn't even sing. She rapped to a really, really hard, fast Macklemore song. And she freaking killed it. It was really, really impressive, and the whole bar was watching.
And she was cute.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know. I mean, who really pays attention to that kind of stuff?
You actually pay more attention to that stuff than anyone else I know, Kevin.
Well, whatever. But it was more the fact that I had never seen someone go up on stage and own a rap song like this. And I didn't know if I was ever going to see karaoke like this again.
So what did you do?
He did nothing.
Nothing? Come on, Kevin. You must have at least, like, shook her hand or something or told her good job.
No. But... Fast forward a couple of months, the Sound Effect team is having their weekly show meeting. And we decide we're going to do a show on Lost and Found. And I come up with this fantastic idea. What if we do a Lost and Found story on me trying to find this karaoke unicorn? Like I said, this performance, at least to me, was kind of an anomaly. And I had nothing to go on other than where I saw her, a vague recollection of what she looked like, and the song that she did, not even a name.
Ah, it's a detective story.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I could record the whole process. I'd talk to the staff at the bar.
Well, no, don't ring a bell. Don't recall ever seeing a performance like that before. You sure you didn't just imagine her?
I'd ask the karaoke guy.
Yeah, I remember that. Don't know who she was, though. Never saw her in my life before that night.
We'd have the story of this whole gumshoe trek of solving this karaoke mystery.
And at the end, Kevin would ask her if she wanted to have coffee.
Would I? I mean, it was kind of all about
you
the performance
oh my God,
for me.
Oh my God, okay.
Okay. Anyway, it never got off the ground.
Why not?
Well, the following week, a friend called me who I hadn't heard from in a while, and she was asking me about work, and I was telling her about this story.
You just told me that you saw a girl at a bar do karaoke, and you wanted to find her, and you knew nothing about her.
Do you remember any details that I gave you about her at all?
She was blonde. She was my age, approximately. And she might have been wearing jeans and the name of the bar.
And what did you say to me?
I said, I can find her.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, first I went on Facebook and I went to the bar's Facebook. I looked through pictures and found a couple people. And I sent you one girl and you said that she was older than the girl that you saw. So then I was done with Facebook and I went on Instagram. And I started searching anyone that was tagged at that bar or posted pictures at that bar. After a while, I found a picture of a like the paper that you get when you sign up for your song. So it had two names. So then I figured out who those girls were, and one of them I sent to you, and it was the right one.
How long do you think this took in total? How much time?
45 minutes. I had found her.
45 minutes.
Yeah.
I gave you an approximate age, a hair color, the name of the bar, and that she might have been wearing jeans.
Yes.
So it took you 45 minutes.
I just found a blonde girl that looked about my age and had been to that bar, and she seemed like she sang karaoke regularly, and it was her.
So Monday morning rolls around, and I go into work, and I tell Arwen this story, and Arwen politely points out that now there is no story. There is no gumshoeing, there is no detective work to be done, because it all really took someone with slightly advanced social media skills and about 45 minutes of free time, and that just doesn't make for the most interesting radio story. That was fail number one on my part.
But you guys actually found her. That's something. That's a place to start.
He didn't find her. Let's just be clear. He ruined it.
Right. Thank you, Arwen. And after all of this, I at least wanted to share this story with her and ask her about her karaoke performance. So through my very basic social media skills, I sent her a message, sheepishly gave her the Cliff Notes version of the story, and she agreed to talk to me on the phone about it. That's where fail number two comes in. Turns out this wasn't some one-time magical performance that she had blessed an audience with. This is kind of thing all the time.
My go-to is Shoop. I like to do Eminem. I'd like to do Montel Jordan. This is how we do it. Sometimes Hot Stepper.
But I don't do it because I think it's super awesome and I'm really good at it. I do it because it's fun and it's a local bar. And usually all the people that are in the audience, typically I know or I've seen them before. So it's a comfortable environment, I guess.
So, Kevin, do you think you would have had the same reaction if she had sung, you know, Salt and Pepper instead of Macklemore?
My bill was paid. I was walking out the door. And if I had heard anything average or bad or crappy or even mildly good, I just would have kept walking. But it stopped me in my tracks. Apparently, though, it doesn't always turn out that great.
Yeah, I did it on Saturday, and it was real bad.
Why was it bad?
It was real bad. I would have messed up Happy Birthday this Saturday. Well, you saw it at 1:30, which is pretty impressive that it was entertaining to you at that point. But this was probably around the same time, and probably a few more alcoholic beverages were involved. So I don't think you would have thought the same thing if you would have seen me last Saturday.
Okay. Well, Kevin, any chance of at least getting that cup of coffee with her?
Gabriel, thank you so much for asking me that.
Well, I mean, at this point, I would say no, being that I'm married, but...
Ooh, fail.
Absolute fail.
Fail. But she was a really good sport. Her husband was a ridiculously good sport, and when it was all said and done, I still think it turned out to be kind of a fun lost and found story after all. What do you guys think?
I guess it's fine.
I give you an A+ for enthusiasm, Kevin.
Love you guys too.
Chandler, everybody, the one and only Chandler. Some call her better than Macklemore. I don't know about that. I might be a little strong.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. We had stories this week from KPLU's Jennifer Wing and Dick Stein. Thanks also to KPLU's Paula Whistle and to John DeGraff and the Boxcar Alehouse. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We want to know what you think of the show. Send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. You can also leave us a review on iTunes and go there to sign up for our podcast. Come on back next week. We'll be pushing the boundaries.
I close my eyes again, and then I hear something again. It's like something large has moved through the bushes, you know. And then I start to hear the grunting.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU. So we put our hands up.